that get used for Jesus, Jesus being amazed. One happens in Mark chapter 6, where Jesus is amazed at the lack of faith of the people from his hometown of Nazareth. In this text, Jesus is amazed positively at the faith that he witnesses in a centurion. It's been a few weeks since I've been with you and since I've walked with you here in Luke's gospel. And when we concluded about four Sundays ago, we concluded Jesus' sermon on the plain recorded in Luke 6. Having begun his ministry, shortly after his baptism and temptation, Jesus' ministry began, and he began to encounter opposition. He began to experience rejection from the Jewish religious establishment. And so Jesus called 12 men, 12 among those who followed him, and he appointed them to be his apostles. He was really reconstituting the people of God. No longer would God's people be the nation of Israel gathered around, centered upon the temple in Jerusalem and the Levitical law and the sacrificial system. Now the new people of God would be the 12 tribes, the 12 disciples would be centered around him, Jesus. And then Jesus, immediately after calling and appointing those 12 as his apostles, he went down and spoke on a level place, Luke says. And he really gave the manifesto of his kingdom. What would this kingdom, what would the new people of God be about? And he began by describing the character of those women and men who would be part of his kingdom. He used four blessed are statements. Blessed are you who are poor. Blessed are you who hunger now. Blessed are you who weep now. Blessed are you who are when people hate you. He describes his people, the character of his people, and then he turns to the ethics of the kingdom, and we walked through Jesus' sermon. He talks about how his kingdom people have love for their enemies, how his kingdom people are merciful, how they are not judgmental, how their lives bear fruit, and it concluded in the last week that we were together with an emphasis on how they grow in obedience to him. They hear his words and obey them. This morning we pick up Luke's text immediately following Jesus' great sermon, the Sermon on the Plain, here in verse 1 of chapter 7. We follow along if you have a Bible with you. When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people who were listening, he entered Capernaum. There a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was sick and about to die. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him, "This man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue." So Jesus went with them. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, "Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. And turning to the crowd following him, he said, "I tell you, I have not found such great faith even in Israel." Then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. As Brad highlighted a few weeks ago, the theme of faith plays a significant role in this passage and throughout Luke's gospel. And this morning, and the rest of the time we have together, I want to circle back and ask three questions of this story particularly this morning. First, where did the centurion's faith come from? Where did it come from? Second, what was the centurion's faith like? What can we say about it? And third, why did the centurion's faith amaze Jesus like it did? Now, just before we ask those three questions, I want to spend a few minutes introducing the centurion to you this morning. Jesus finishes his sermon and returns to Capernaum. Now, Capernaum wasn't his hometown, not where he was from, but it was his hometown now. Jesus lived here at this point in time. And Luke tells us there's a centurion there who had a servant who was sick. Not just kind of sick, but on the verge of death. So he's really sick. And this man, the centurion, really cares for this servant. He is highly valued to him. And so he is a key figure in this story, the centurion. Who is he? What do we know about him? Well, first, he was a soldier. He was a military man. Evidently, he had so distinguished himself as a soldier that he had risen to the rank of centurion, a leader of soldiers. Really, a centurion was an army captain. They would have about 100 soldiers under their command, and each centurion would be directly responsible to a general who was then directly responsible to the emperor or to the king. So we know that he was a military man of some rank. Second, he was a non-Jew. We're not sure if he was necessarily a Roman soldier. He may have been, he was certainly a Gentile, but not necessarily a Roman soldier. At this point in history, Judea was ultimately under the control of Rome, but that authority had been delegated to King Herod Antipas at this point in time. So whether he was a centurion under Herod or a centurion under the emperor of Rome, either way, we know that he was a Gentile. And that's significant for Luke. Remember, Luke is he's writing the gospel for outsiders. He's the gospel for those on the wrong side of the proverbial tracks, for tax collectors like Levi, for a prostitute that we will encounter later on in chapter 7, for women, for Gentiles, for non-Jews, for those people on the outside in that culture. So that was significant that he is a Gentile. Third, he was wealthy. We'll come back to this in a bit, but the Jewish elders that he calls and sends to Jesus assert the fact that this centurion actually paid for the construction of their synagogue. So he is wealthy, not just wealthy, but generous too. And fourth, he was sympathetic to the Jewish people. In fact, sympathetic is not really a strong enough word. the Jewish elders tell Jesus that he loves our nation. Jennifer, we'll talk later, okay? And that is unusual for sure. Whether he was Roman or not, many centurions were racist and arrogant towards the conquered nations, the conquered people under their rule. But he evidently was not like that. He had come somehow to love the Jewish people, to love the nation of Israel. It would be really interesting to know that story. What led him to that place? What birthed that in his heart? But alas, we're not told that. Now, with all that in mind about the centurion, let's turn our attention to the first question I wanted to ask this morning, and that was, where did the centurion's faith come from? How did it come to be? I want to contend this morning that faith is actually a pretty natural thing. It's virtually inevitable for every human being. Everyone has faith. Everyone believes something. Everyone trusts something. Merriam-Webster's dictionary defines the word faith this way, as strong belief or trust in someone or something. It's only secondarily that the dictionary says that faith is belief in the existence of God. That's typically what we think of when we speak of faith, but the truth is faith is strong belief or trust in someone or something, and everyone believes. Everyone has faith. We actually see this in our text. If you look with me at what the Jewish elders mentioned here, the centurion's servant dear to him, is sick and near the point of death, so he calls Jewish elders in Capernaum to come. Now, these are not priests from Jerusalem. These are not Pharisees. These are not the teachers of the law that we've encountered earlier. They are the elders in Capernaum, the elders, essentially the board of elders of the synagogue in Capernaum, likely. And he calls them and he sends them to Jesus. Now, they are not said to believe in Jesus, these elders of the Jews. They're certainly not followers of Jesus. They're simply running an errand, an important errand for their benefactor, for the centurion who paid for their synagogue, who loves their nation. And so they're not believers in Jesus, but they go. They go to ask Jesus to come to the centurion's house and to heal his servant. Listen to what they say when they come to Jesus. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him, "This man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue." Do you see where their faith is? Do you see what it is they believe? They don't believe in Jesus, but they do believe from another perspective. They believe that this man, the centurion, their friend, is a virtuous man. And they believe that because he loves their nation and because he's paid for their synagogue, they believe that he deserves to have the power of God work through Jesus to heal his servant. Do you catch that? That's what they believe. They have faith in this system that says his moral goodness, his virtue, means that he deserves to have the power of God work. They believe that you can earn, that you can merit, that you can deserve to have God act in your life the way you want him to act. In other words, if a person does A and B and C, then God is obligated, because it's deserved, God's obligated to respond in, you fill in the blank. And we hear this, don't we, even in our world. That was a good person. They didn't deserve this. That betrays a faith that our moral goodness, that our performance somehow merits, earns, deserves God acting in a particular way. This is a belief system that we see in our world, and sadly, sometimes it even impacts us and how we think, even as believers. We begin to think in this, I call it vending machine kind of theology, that if I do A, B, and C, then God will give me the candy bar that I want, and we're actually after things from God rather than wanting God himself. We all believe something, so faith is actually a very natural thing. It's a human thing. Now, whether or not people always recognize that is another case. I think many people in our culture today profess that they do not believe in God. But even that statement, to say that they do not believe in God, you cannot not believe in God without believing something else. I mean, if you say, I don't believe in God, then you need to, whether you recognize it and articulate it, you believe then that all of what you see, all that you experience in this cosmos has happened through pure random chance, that life ultimately has no meaning other than what we inject into it ourselves, that one day you will die and feed worms. You believe something. Whether you can express it, whether you can articulate it, you cannot not believe in God without believing something else. You do believe. Everybody has faith. Some will argue in our day, in our culture, that you cannot be, that no one can be certain about God. That you cannot be sure. That you cannot be sure you're right about God. But at the very same time, they are asserting something that they cannot be sure of. They cannot be sure that there is no God. And so even that position is a faith position. And they are basing their future on that belief, that faith statement. So regardless of what you believe, whether you recognize it as faith or not, it is very natural, it's virtually impossible to not have faith as a human being. We all believe something. So at the end of the day, the answer to our question, where did the centurion's faith come from? We have to at least on the one hand say, well, faith simply is. Everyone has faith. So he, like everyone else, has faith. Now, that leads us to a secondary follow-up question. Okay, fine, but how did this Gentile, this former pagan, this centurion, come to have faith in Jesus? Okay, let's look at that. One of the things that we need to say is that he came to faith when he encountered a crisis in his life. See, he didn't call for Jesus when everything in his life was going well. It was in this moment, this circumstance, where one of his servants, who he was very fond of, someone that he valued highly, he was sick and at the point of death, and in this moment of crisis, the centurion calls out to Jesus. His faith in Jesus arises in the midst of crisis, in the midst of this major life difficulty. That's actually pretty normal, too, when we speak of religious faith, faith in Jesus, Christian faith. Many people come to faith in Jesus when they experience crisis, when they experience difficulty. Now, some people are cynical about that when faith arises through trials. Someone gets sick and they're in the hospital. They face terminal illness. They put their faith in God. You lose your job and you call out to God. Something else bad happens and you call out to God. That's not unusual. And just because that faith arises out of crisis, out of difficult circumstances, does not make it illegitimate. But that's one of the realities of faith for many, that it arises in crisis, out of crisis. It's those moments of difficulty in life, those moments of crisis in life, that we stop and we ask those big questions. Is there hope? Is there meaning? Is there purpose in life? Is this all there is? Will my life have any lasting value at all? When life goes smoothly, when all is going well, we tend not to slow down and ask those questions. C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters, it's a fiction book with letters between a senior devil and a junior devil, and the senior devil's advising the junior devil on how to deal with his clients. And at one point, the senior devil writes to the junior devil and says, if you ever have a client who begins to ask big questions, please don't argue with him. Just get him busy with life. Just get them busy with life, because in the midst of ordinary life, in the midst of busyness, we tend not to ask those deep questions. But when crisis hits, that's when we often call out, when we stop and we think deeply about these difficult things. And that's what happened here in the centurion's life. This servant who is dear to him, who he highly values, is sick and nearly dead. And he cries out to Jesus. He calls out to Jesus. So that brings us to our second question. What was the centurion's faith like? What can we say about it? You know, we can contend that faith is natural for every human being, whether we recognize it or not. And we can recognize that the centurion's faith in Jesus arose out of crisis in his life. But what more can we say? What was his faith like? It is possible, perhaps even likely, though not certain, that this centurion was what we would call a God-fearer. That's a term used throughout the New Testament to speak of Gentiles who began to believe in and worship the God of Israel, but who didn't fully become Jewish through the rite of circumcision. So he may well be a God-fearer, worshiping the God of Israel. We're not sure about that. What we do know is that he had grown to love the nation of Israel. He'd grown to love the nation of God's people. And we know that he had been exceptionally generous, paying for the construction of a synagogue in Capernaum. But it seems entirely reasonable also to assert that he was not a follower of Jesus, that they had probably not ever met before, though perhaps the centurion who's in Capernaum has seen Jesus, but certainly he has heard of Jesus. He's heard that Jesus heals people. Until now, perhaps he's had no need to ever bother with Jesus. But back in Luke 4, those of you who've been with us through this series, you'll remember this, that Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law of a high fever here in Capernaum. And then we read this, at sunset, the people brought to Jesus all who had various kinds of sickness, and laying his hands on each one, he healed them. That happened here in Capernaum. So the centurion has heard these stories. He's aware of Jesus the healer. But he's not a follower, doesn't know Jesus. And now his dear servant is sick and about to die, and he believes that Jesus can stop that from happening. He believes that Jesus has access to power through which this servant of his can be healed. We don't know that he believes anything more than that at this point in time. But look with me at what happens next in the story. He calls the Jewish elders, that is the board of elders, essentially the local synagogue, he calls them to him and he sends them to ask Jesus to come to his home to heal his servant. And Jesus hears that request and he goes with them. But before he gets to the centurion's house, he's getting close already. Luke says he was not far away from the house when the centurion sent friends to him with a different message. And we don't know what happened in the centurion's mind, but he sent these elders to get Jesus. Jesus is coming. Maybe he looked up and he saw him coming. He's like, hang on, this can't happen. He says, don't come. Don't trouble yourself. Why? Why the sudden change of heart? What, has a servant died? I mean, think of that story in Mark's gospel, the 12-year-old girl whose parents send for Jesus, and then before he gets there, they say, don't bother him, she's dead. Has his servant died? No. Has he had a change of heart? Does he go, you know what? Actually, I'll just get a new servant. I don't need him. Don't bother. Why does he change his mind? Why does he say, don't come? Don't trouble yourself. Look with me at what the centurion says in verses 7 and 8. Here's his message to Jesus. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. So the centurion still longs for his servant to be healed, longs for his servant to live. What he is expressing here is the belief that Jesus doesn't have to be present in order to heal, that he doesn't have to even come into his house to heal, that Jesus can simply say the word. He can speak and heal from a distance. Now that's pretty impressive faith on the one hand, isn't it? It's not like any other healer. I mean, he doesn't even have to be present. Just speak the word. But I want you to notice something else interesting. Look again with me at the illustration that the centurion uses. He says this, for I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. Do you notice? He doesn't say, I am a man with authority. He says, I am a man under authority. I'm a man under authority. Remember, centurion was directly responsible to a general who was then directly responsible to the emperor or to the king. And it's through them, from the emperor to the general to the centurion, that he had authority then for the soldiers under him. He says, I am a man under authority. What's the implication as he speaks this to Jesus? He says, Jesus, I'm a man under authority. This is how it works. I say something and my soldiers do it. He is seeing Jesus to be like him in this. He's seeing Jesus as being in a unique relationship with God, that somehow Jesus has access, or the power of God works through this man, Jesus. I'm a man under authority. Jesus, just like you, somehow God's authority is working through you. So notice this. He doesn't know that Jesus is God in the flesh. This is not some, you know, Christological statement. You're God. The Word become flesh. You're God. No, he's saying, I recognize that there's authority that's flowing through you. This chapter, chapter 7, as we continue to work our way through it, is a chapter about who Jesus is, Jesus' own self-revelation. Who is he? Who is he? And in just a couple of weeks, we're going to look at a passage where John the Baptist, the forerunner of Jesus, the one called to prepare the way, he's going to send his followers to Jesus with this question: are you the one? Or should we be expecting someone else? See, it's not immediately clear to people who Jesus is. They don't recognize this is God in human flesh. This is God incarnate. And certainly the centurion doesn't get that. I'm a man under authority just like you, Jesus. Somehow the power of God is working through you. And so you can do this. Not because you're God, not because you have power, but because you're a man under authority like me. If we know that this chapter, that the gospel is ultimately about revealing who Jesus is, it would seem that the centurion has failed to grasp that. He believes Jesus can heal his servant. He believes that Jesus is uniquely connected to God, that God's power somehow flows through him. But he doesn't understand that Jesus is in fact God in the flesh. And yet it's at this point in the story that Jesus says this. When Jesus heard this, we read this. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. He was amazed at him. And turning to the crowd following him, he said, I tell you, I have not found such great faith even in Israel. Jesus is amazed. He marvels. He stands filled with wonder. This, when it says Jesus is amazed, it's not like Jesus is amazed, surprised, like, I can't believe that happened. He's amazed, like wonder. Filled with wonder. As you watch the video, I kept watching many of you, and you just sit there, consciously or not, just a smile, and just like, wow, how do you do that thing with a paper towel? It's like, Jesus is amazed. He's filled with wonder. Not because this man has faith, but because this man, unlike others to this point, this Gentile, this soldier, this centurion, he's getting something that others haven't. Which leads us to our third question. Why did the centurion's faith amaze Jesus? Do you remember the Jewish elders that the centurion sent to Jesus in the beginning? Sent them to ask Jesus to come and to heal his servant? They said this. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him, this man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue. But then while Jesus is on his way, Jesus is nearing the house, perhaps the centurion looks up and he sees Jesus coming down the road. He has this change of heart, change of mind. He says, don't come, just say the word. Why did he rethink that? Why did he rethink his original request to Jesus? Yes, he believed that Jesus could heal simply by speaking the word, but that doesn't necessitate that Jesus not come, right? Jesus could come too and be present. Why shouldn't he just come and heal him? Look at what the centurion says. Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. Do you see how what he says stands in stark contrast to what the Jewish elders had said. The Jewish elders had said, they said, Jesus, come and heal him because he deserves this. The centurion says, Jesus, don't come because I don't deserve this. Now, if the centurion had said, Jesus, don't come, I don't deserve it, I change my request, don't bother healing my servant, then he would be on the same page with the Jewish elders. What they were saying was different, but it would come out of the same paradigm. Right? The Jewish elders said, Jesus, please come and heal because he deserves this. And if the centurion had said, Jesus, don't come because I don't deserve it and don't heal him. Both of those would come out of this paradigm that says what we get from God is based on what we deserve. But that's not what goes on here. You see, the centurion said, Jesus, don't come. I don't deserve. I'm not worthy, but please heal. At the heart, the Jewish elders' request arises from the belief that we get what we deserve, that somehow our moral goodness, our moral performance can merit God's power, his saving, healing power in our lives. But the centurion, he knew that wasn't the case. He didn't withdraw his request. He desperately wanted Jesus to act, to pour out his power, to heal, to save. But he said, I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy. I don't deserve this, but please heal my servant. He recognized that what he was asking for, that what he needed was not something he deserved, not something he could earn, not something he could merit. That if Jesus were to do this, if Jesus was to act and heal, if Jesus was to act and save, that it would have to be on another basis, apart from his moral performance. See, it's only in Christianity that we see this. It's only in Christianity that we see this, where we see that we are not worthy, that we do not deserve God's mercy, we do not deserve God's love, we do not deserve God's saving work in our lives. But we cry out to him, we're invited to cry out to him, please save me. Please heal me. Heal me of my sin. Heal me of my brokenness. Heal me, Jesus. Make me who you made me to be. Not because I deserve it, not because I've earned it, not because of my moral goodness, my moral performance. Jesus, on another basis, save me. And when we get that, we're beginning to get the gospel. We're beginning to get the good news. And that's what Jesus sees in the centurion. And he's amazed, he's filled with wonder, because this is what he's after. This is what he wants for everyone to get. To see, understand that his saving power, his saving work is a gift based not on our moral goodness, not on our performance, not on our lovability, but it is based entirely on his grace, on his love. It's not deserved, it's not merited, it's not earned. It's a free gift through faith. The faith of the centurion, when we look closely at this story, it was an imperfect faith. He didn't get who Jesus was, not fully. He knew there was something between him and God, that God's power was at work in him, but he did not understand that Jesus was the Word made flesh. His faith was not fully formed, but it was rightly focused. It was directed to Jesus. Tim Keller tells a story of two mountain climbers who slip and fall, and they land on this ledge. And from that ledge, there are two possible ways to get off the mountain. In the first, mountain climber speaks really boldly with great confidence, great faith. He says, it's this little rock outcrop here. I have complete confidence that we can step on that and get off the mountain. I have no doubts, totally believe it, totally confident this is going to work. The other mountain climber says, you know, I think we need to go on this one. I'm not so sure. I'm scared to death, but I really think I need to choose this one. The first mountain climber steps, and the rock doesn't hold, and he falls off the mountain. The second mountain climber steps the other way onto the rock outcrop that he thought maybe might be, wasn't sure, but he stepped that way and he got off the mountain safely. Keller asks the question, who was saved? The man whose faith was strong and bold and full of confidence and no doubt? No, the man who believed in the right rock. Therein is the comfort for us. What is of ultimate importance is not the strength of our faith, not the perfection of our faith, but the object of our faith. The centurion, he knew that Jesus could do what he desperately needed, what he desperately wanted. And he knew that he was unworthy, and yet he cried out to Jesus and said, Jesus, not because I deserve it, not because I'm worthy, but on some other basis, would you please save, would you please heal? That's the gospel. That's Christian faith, that's saving faith. To know your unworthiness, to know your unworthiness, and yet to simply cry out to Jesus to save you on some other basis, and we know the basis is his life of obedience and his sin-atoning death. Do you believe that? Is your faith aimed to Jesus? Can you this morning say, Jesus, you really are my only hope? When you stop and think deeply, where is your confidence? When your confidence is shaken, is it because you just recognize that you screwed up in life, that you stumbled in sin, and suddenly, oh no, my moral goodness isn't so good today? Or is your confidence in Jesus? Do you recognize that you'll never deserve what you need, and that he is gracious and loving to pour out his grace and to save you, to make you his, that your security in Christ comes not because of your growth or the strength of your faith or the perfection of your understanding. It comes through Jesus and through Jesus alone, his grace alone. Do you believe the gospel? Do you have faith like the centurion? Can you say this morning, Jesus, I don't deserve this. I am unworthy. Please save me. As those who are saved, if you're here and you're a Christian already, can you just rest in that place? Jesus, it's not because I deserve this. Your love for me is not contingent upon the strength of my faith, the perfection of my faith. It's contingent upon your sin-atoning death, your gift of righteousness for me. That's what we're called to believe. That's the faith that Jesus invites us to. That's the faith that Jesus longs for us to have. That's the faith. That's the faith that amazes Jesus. Can you imagine this morning? Jesus standing here. He is present with us right now. Standing in amazement, marveling at the people of God who say together, we don't deserve this, Jesus, but by your grace, the basis of your grace, we are yours. That's faith that amazes Jesus. Amen.